Welcome back to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we bridge learning gaps and empower families to access the special education services they need. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I'm thrilled to kick off season 3 with you. Our podcast is your go-to resource for special education, offering expert insights, inspiring stories, and actionable tips to help your child thrive. In this season, we'll dive deeper into the world of special education. So whether you're a parent, educator, or passionate advocate, join us in this journey. To make this season unforgettable, please like, listen, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Your support helps us reach more families and create a stronger, more inclusive future. So hit that subscribe button, join our community, and let's make season 3 a game changer. Thanks to listeners like you. Hello and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I am excited to have a conversation today about mental health and navigating mental health. So we talk a lot about all things special ed, and mental health is a big part of that. And so I'm excited for our guests to help clarify any questions and really help get you in the right direction if you're feeling that you and your family or your student need support. So Alex, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Wendy.
Before we dive in, can you just tell our listeners who you are, a little bit about yourself, and how you kind of help be a special ed strategist?
Yeah. So my name is Alex Williams. I am the clinical outreach specialist with Anxiety Institute, which is an IOP program in McLean, Virginia. And we'll talk a little bit more about what an IOP program is. But my role in the community is to meet with therapists, clinicians, pediatricians, and connect them with the resources that they need to support families. So when families come to them and ask for resources, I can help be a connector to different mental health resources in the area. So I've been around the block for a few years and been in the industry, and I'm excited to just share some helpful tips for finding mental health resources and navigating the area.
Absolutely. And I think it's pretty overwhelming, especially if you are a parent in the midst of it, to know where to go. And I think it's such a personal, emotional process for parents. And so having this guidance is going to be tremendous. Before we get into that, I like to ask my guests, before they get into the conversation, what is a little known fact about you that has nothing to do with your profession?
I really love challenging myself creatively with art stuff. So I'll take a random pottery class or sewing class, or I'm really into interior design, and I love thrifting, and I love finding kind of like vintage items. So anything kind of artsy that I can get into and dig into, I really enjoy doing. So that's kind of like my off the clock hobby time.
So fun. I actually just went thrifting with my son yesterday. So that was pretty fun. He's home for spring break. So I love all that creative stuff. Very fun.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how to navigate the world of mental health. And I think if we could start really at the basics, as a parent, you feel like something's off with your kiddo and you are either kind of thinking, oh, we're going to turn a corner here soon, or, oh, it was just this event or that event. What are some things that a parent should look out for and know, like, this should be a red flag and let's not just kind of wait and see on it?
Yeah. So it's important to remember that not every child or adolescent needs therapeutic intervention for, you know, a rough time that they're going through or moving into puberty, that sort of thing. But there are some very specific things that parents should be on the lookout for, specific changes in their child that could happen that maybe would indicate that they need some additional mental health support. So one of the biggest things is changes in mood or behavior. So any sudden mood swings or unexplained changes in their behavior, like irritability, agitation, hostility, especially when confronted about their change in behavior. any changes in appetite or weight loss or sudden weight gain, sleep disturbances, insomnia, or excessive sleep. Those are all things that could indicate maybe there's some additional support that may be needed. Also, any decline in academic or athletic performance. Maybe your kiddo was really loving soccer and now they don't really want to go anymore, or they really loved Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts, and that's just not something they're interested in anymore. They're staying home more, isolating more. Changes in their social circle. So any conflict with peers or isolation from friends that they used to have. Any sort of, and this can also be changes for signs of substance use as well. This is a big thing for teenagers right now that parents really want to keep an eye on, is not only depression, anxiety, things like that, but also substance use. Substance use is something that our teens are kind of met with a lot and have to face, and kind of an issue that they have to deal with. So that's something else to be on the lookout for. So any kind of secretness or deception, are they doing things and you're not really sure what's going on with their friend group, or they started keeping secrets from you in general? That might be something, that we need to look out for. Persistent feelings of sadness or irritability, again, so changes in moods and emotions, a really big thing. And sometimes this can happen with the onset of puberty, right? Like our teens' hormones are fluctuating. There's lots of feelings going on, but is it getting to a point where it's kind of disturbing their relationships? It's affecting their ability to perform in school or their ability to engage outside of school or with their friend groups. So those are really the biggest things to look out for in terms of, do we need to start bringing in some extra professional help?
You brought up a good point about puberty, right? And so, how do we measure if this is a puberty thing, if this is something that we really need to explore other options? And then, is there a time frame, right? So, if there's like a blip on the radar, like when I talk about grades or students with learning, if a blip on the radar is expected, but then you want to look for that pattern, is that similar with mental health? And what does that look like?
Yeah, so really look out for, is it getting in the way or is it affecting them negatively in multiple aspects of their life? So, you could have a teenager at home who is a little bit more irritable, but they're otherwise their friend group is okay. They're engaging in outside activities, they're doing okay in school, they're able to get to school. So, be the judge. You as parents kind of know your children the best. And so you can really be the judge of, is this really kind of just hormonal reacting, or are these things really keeping them from living their best life and being the most successful and happy teenager or child they can be? So when it starts impacting them in multiple areas of their life, I would say then is really the time to start looking into maybe some professional intervention. And then time frame, really, it's going to depend on the child. So sometimes symptoms can really escalate quickly and you have to kind of get ahead of it. Or sometimes, again, with puberty and hormones, it can last for, months and years. And you help them build resilience to kind of help them with their emotional distress and their stress and their emotional regulation. We as parents can really help our children emotionally regulate. And I will plug a book by local clinicians that I think is amazing. It's called Raising a Kid Who Can. And it's a whole, and I'll send you the resource for that. But it's a whole book and it's like easy tools for parents on helping their children build resilience and emotional resilience. And so that's something that we can, as parents, kind of start really early so that as our children get into their teenage years, they're able to regulate their emotions a little bit better. They're able to understand what's going on with them and maybe why they're more irritable or why they're more emotional. And so for time frame, really it is child specific. And if it is starting to impact their life in multiple areas, I would say then it becomes a little bit more pressing of an issue to kind of start intervening.
So how do we tease out that behavior or mood that may be impacting a kid, especially if you have a kiddo that is not super communicative, meaning that they're just saying, I'm fine, don't worry about me. And sometimes that could be True, but sometimes your spidey sense as a parent starting to flicker. So how can we tease that out of what is truly fine and what is like, whew, we've got to do something fine.
Yeah, so I'm not a clinician. I just want to say that I'm not a clinician. And so for real clinical parent support advice, definitely we'll talk about helping, finding support for that too. But I would say parents, I've run some parent groups through some of the positions I've had, and parents are so worried that they're not talking to their kids enough. Like there's this anxiety around the car that I've noticed a lot. Like, the only time that I can get my kid to talk to me is in the car. And so there's all this pressure around the car. And if your kid isn't talking to you while you're in the car, it's like parents are coming unglued because they think that they're not doing enough to support their children. I would say, give again, your child well as a parent. And so, give your child the space that they need. If they're seeming extra withdrawn, I think that we as parents really know when there's, the slam the door, turn the music up high, I don't want to talk to anyone versus isolation, right? So is your child kind of secluding themselves, not just from the family, but from their friends? Are they withdrawing in general at school? Maybe they're coming home and they're not as bubbly as they used to be when they would come home, or not as energetic. So, parents really shouldn't put as much pressure on themselves as they do to, have these life-changing conversations with their teens all the time, right? And so, and your teens are listening and they care what you say, but they're just not always going to be just giving you all of their feelings all of the time, right? And we as parents have to be comfortable kind of sitting with that and understanding that it's okay for them to come to us. But looking, so not as much about the communication, but just observing their behaviors, not just at home, but outside of the home. And so if their behaviors have really shifted and they don't really seem like the same kid that they were a year ago, 2 years ago, then maybe it's time to check in and say, hey, like as a parent, you can say, hey, I've noticed that maybe you've been acting a little bit differently, or you're not as excited to go to school, or you're not as excited about your extracurriculars. I want to support you. What's going on? How can I help? And, doing those check-ins with your teen just to say, like, I'm here for you. I know that I'm in tune with what you're feeling and what you're doing. So how can I support you? I think goes a really long way. And so just knowing, being secure in yourself as a parent that you're doing enough and that you're talking enough, and then, trusting yourself that you know your child well enough to know that if something is changing and they need help, that you're able to do that and get that help for them.
As a parent, so we've looked at kind of, all right, we know it's time to get services or to get help. How do I navigate this world of mental health resources? And then where am I starting?
Yeah, so say either you or your teen has decided that they want some extra support. They need some extra mental health support. I think the biggest, it's really daunting when you decide, okay, we're going to look for a therapist. And you're like, where do I even go? What do I even do? Where do I search? And so it's important to know just kind of some different things about the mental health industry. So first is the different levels of care. So when we say levels of care, what we mean are different levels of intervention and intensity in intervention based on differing acuity of symptoms. So let's say, let's just say that your child is, just struggling with the stress of transition into high school, right? So maybe they're just a little bit more anxious, they're a little stressed out. In that kind of situation, you might look for an outpatient therapist first. And honestly, I would recommend, unless there's an emergency situation where your child is, experiencing suicidal ideation or something like that, most of the time, families are going to access outpatient services first. So that's what most people think about with therapy, is just that once or twice a week, meeting with a therapist. And so there are different types of therapists that you can look for as well. So a lot of people, when they see all of the different acronyms, it gets a little overwhelming. And so we can talk about what different therapists are. So LPCs are licensed practicing counselors or clinicians. Those types of therapists have a background typically in psychology. Really, it's really these different types of therapists. It's just slight differences in their education and training, but they're all going to be effective. They all know the different types of therapy to give. It's just about kind of different approaches in their education and training. So LPCs are the licensed professional counselors. They have usually a background in psychology. They're master's level clinicians. Then there's LCSWs, who are licensed clinical social workers. Those clinicians have a background in social work, also master's level clinicians. Then there's LMFTs, or licensed marriage and family therapists. Those, again, they LMFTs kind of have their own specialized background and training. They're also master's level clinicians. They do a lot more work with that family piece, right? So if you're looking for family support or couples support, LMFTs are a really good place to go. Then there's the PhD level therapists, or PsyDs. They usually have a doctorate in clinical psychology. And then those professionals can also do additional testing. So if you're recommended for your child to go for psychoed testing or neurological testing, those PsyDs who also have a background in psychology can typically do that testing. And then there's MDs, who are typically, they've been through med school, and those are the psychiatrists. So they can prescribe medication for your mental health symptoms. So when you're looking through your options for therapists, those are kind of the types of therapists that you can reach out to. So that's outpatient therapy. And then there's also outpatient psychiatry, where you just go see a psychiatrist for medication management. A lot of people will see a psychiatrist for ADHD medication, depression, anxiety medication, and you usually do that in tandem with a therapist. So yeah, that's outpatient therapy. Is there, I can stop and answer any questions about outpatient.
Yeah, let me ask you, because if I'm a parent, or I am a parent, and I'm bringing my little one, and I have teenagers, but I still call them my babies, right? So if I'm a parent and I'm bringing my kiddo to one of the types of therapists you just mentioned, I would assume that that's with the child or with my kiddo. But how is the family then incorporated into that treatment, right? So as a parent, I know that there's confidentiality. So how do therapists bridge that gap in terms of helping the parent grow with their understanding or skills or whatever it may be, so that they can better support their child at home? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So typically when you're getting services for your child, the therapist will do an assessment with both the child and then perhaps maybe the family as a whole. So it depends on the therapist that you go to. I would say most clinicians will incorporate some level of support for the parents and the family, especially if they're treating someone under the age of 16. So when the client is a lot younger, a lot of therapists will recommend family therapy, and then maybe also separate therapy or separate coaching for the parents as well. So it just kind of depends on what that child is, what their symptoms are, what they're working on, and then what the treatment plan that that individual therapist comes up with is. But typically they will incorporate some level of family support and parent support. And I would say just keep in close contact with your child's therapist. If you feel like you want more support, then you can always ask for family sessions or ask for additional resources from that therapist, so that you as a parent can have your own support individually. Parents often report that that is the biggest help for them, is just getting their own therapeutic support, especially while their child is in treatment, because it's stressful, right? It's really, you know, we're worried about our kids. We want them to be okay. And we can learn, as parents, learn tools along with our child so that we can best support them. So the biggest advice in general when you're a parent navigating mental health resources for your child is just to be an advocate for your child. So always ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask for additional resources. Don't be afraid to ask for, ask clarifying questions. If you don't understand something or you want something more, always be communicative with your therapist because they're there to help and that's kind of what they're there for. So yeah, just really be an advocate and don't be afraid to ask questions and to keep digging.
Yes, yes, and yes. I always encourage with IEP coaching parents to be that advocate because no matter where you are, or what realm in the community, at home, in the school environment, as a parent, you are that cons or caregiver, you are that consistent member of whether it's the mental health team, the special education team, whatever team it is, you're that consistent member. So having that empowerment is huge. When
Absolutely.
we talk about this outpatient, right? There's a lot of different terms. So you mentioned different trainings for therapists, but what about CBT or DBT or DBTC? All these acronyms may seem overwhelming. And as a parent, if you're calling to say, I need this for something for my child, how do we know what to specifically ask for?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So CBT, DBT, ACT, all of these different types of therapeutic interventions we call modalities. And so therapists will have specific specialties with these modalities. So, for example, at Anxiety Institute, we do only CBT, which stands for cognitive behavioral therapy, and ERP, which stands for exposure and response prevention therapy. Those types of interventions are proven to work for OCD and anxiety, but something like EMDR is specifically proven to work with trauma. And so I would say, as a parent, you really don't have to be an expert in all of these different modalities. Find a therapist first, and we'll talk about when you're finding a therapist, what to look for. But when you're talking to clinicians initially to get services, I would tell them what your child is dealing with and ask them what is the best course of action for us and when finding a therapist. Are you, for OCD and anxiety, you're going to look for an ERP therapist, but maybe there's a trauma component, or you're just working on general emotional regulation. That's really good for DBT. And so you, as a parent, you don't have to know all of those things, but just ask questions like, my child is dealing with this. What sort of therapist should I be looking into? And if you talk to three therapists at the beginning and you ask that question, they'll be able to really say, okay, you're dealing with some anxiety and some depression. Let's try to find you a DBT group. And so I wouldn't worry too much about all the different modalities. And guess what? There's like new modalities popping up every day. And so you can't keep up with it. I, as a mental health professional, I probably don't know all the modalities either. There's a few that are popping up, like internal family systems. That's a cool new modality that people are learning about. So really, it's just ways to do therapy. And so whatever therapist you talk to will know the best course of action based on the symptoms that you talk to them about.
Phew, thank heavens. Thank heavens. And it goes back to asking the question. And I always will ask when I'm asking questions from anywhere from an outfit to something more serious. If I feel like I need more understanding, I would say, what would you tell your sister to do? And that
Exactly.
has gotten me a lot of good answers in life. I mean, you can switch it up to brother, cousin, friend, aunt, whomever. And that has helped as well. So that takes a load off that you don't have to know every modality, that we just need to start a conversation and asking the question. So, in terms of outpatient, is there any other information that we need to know right now before we go on to the other types of services?
Yeah, so I would say just to for finding an outpatient therapist, there are a few resources that are best to find an outpatient therapist. And when you're looking at the other levels of care that we're talking about, to find those levels of care, typically leaning on the clinicians that you reach out to recommend, a different IOP or a PHP is best.
So after outpatients, if that's not helping to get my kiddo to the level of mental health for them to be successful. What are other options?
Yeah. And so I'll preface this by saying my recommendation is to always reach out to an outpatient therapist first. They will know other options in the area that would be good for you. And so you're not going on a wild goose chase looking, Googling, you know, different acronyms and not knowing what you're looking at. And so even if you do think maybe my child needs more than once or twice a week outpatient, it's always best to reach out to a therapist first for recommendations on where to go next. But so if your child has tried outpatient therapy for, you know, once or twice a week for a month or two, and symptoms really are not getting better, they're still struggling with, you know, whatever they're struggling with, depression, anxiety, and especially if the outpatient therapist recommends, oftentimes outpatient therapists will recommend a higher level of care if they know that what they're doing in once or twice a week outpatient isn't enough. So the next step up is something called an IOP, or intensive outpatient program. That option is typically 3 to 4 hours a day, 3 to 5 days a week, depending on the program. Typically, it is after school. So patients can still go to school and then go to this higher level of care after school. And so this is really an option for those kids who maybe would benefit from some additional groups. Maybe that social aspect and having treatment with their peers is going to be helpful. But then also just they need more support, more individual therapy, more group time, just more time spent on working on their mental health symptoms. So that's the IOP option. And again, an outpatient therapist will typically recommend IOP if it's something that they think is necessary. The next step up from IOP is something called PHP, or partial hospitalization program. This is typically for those clients who have maybe they've experienced some suicidal ideation. They're stable, but they need all day support. So a PHP is typically 4 to 5 hours a day, 5 days a week. They're in program all day. They're usually not in school, or they're doing virtual school while they're in PHP. And this is really for safety. Maybe they need that extra support, but they are safe when they go home. They're stable enough to go home and be with their family, but not so stable that they can be doing school and extracurriculars and all of that stuff. They really need that time to work on their mental health and work on getting better and healing. And so typically, someone would go to a PHP either from being hospitalized for safety or as a step down from a residential level of care. If a student goes into an IOP program and is assessed that they're not stable, so they're at risk of having suicidal ideation, then sometimes the IOP will recommend a step up to a PHP program. So that's PHP. Hospitalization, so inpatient hospitalization, is really for stabilizing and helping that student be safe. So maybe they're actively experiencing suicidal ideation. They're not safe at home. They're not safe without being observed and watched. So they'll go to the hospital and stay at the hospital for what we call stabilizing. So they'll be at the hospital for maybe a week or 2 weeks. And that gives them time to get on some medication if that's necessary, get some therapeutic intervention while they're in the hospital. But it really is kind of short-term stabilizing. And then after hospitalization, typically they'll either go to a residential setting or they'll go down to a PHP. So next step up above hospitalization is a residential setting. So this is really for student and family stabilization. So if a student really is not safe at home in that family environment, or the family isn't safe with that student in the home, residential level of care is often a really great way to kind of take a break from the family dynamic being all together so that that student can really work on their own mental health. And then the family can also get support and we can support them together as needed in program. For residential level of care, I often tell parents, you know, if you have to stay up all night, watching your kid, or you have to lock up knives or lock up sharps, and you don't trust your child to be alone because you're nervous something bad is going to happen, that's really when either hospitalization or residential level of care is needed. And typically residential level of care is about, with an insurance-based program, usually about 3 months. So it gives them time to really stabilize outside of that home environment. And then the clinical team and the residential level of care can help them with that transition back into home environment so that, you know, the dynamic is a lot more healthy and the family is really supported. And typically from residential, a student can go down to PHP. So they're still being supported during the day, but now they're able to be home at night and be safe. So really it is about safety, the different levels of care. We want to make sure that our kids are safe and healthy and not at risk of any danger to them or other people. And so depending on where that level of safety is really what the recommendation for level of care is going to be.
How have you seen the communication work best in between families that have a student in either IOP or PHP or hospitalization? How do they best communicate with the school team, or just either letting them know, or is there a collaboration? How have you seen that work best?
Yeah, so the best programs work really closely with schools, right? Because we know that often school is really the biggest stressor for most of our kids, and especially in the DC area, school is a really, really big stressor. And so we want to make sure that they're supported when they go back to school, that the transition is smooth, that they know what to expect, that they are able to kind of participate in a way that is conducive to learning and being successful. And so the best programs, really, they have it in place. They have a team member in place whose job it is to work with schools for transition back. I know at Anxiety Institute, we are an IOP, but most of the time our clients are not in school due to extreme anxiety. We deal with a lot of school refusal. And so part of our transition for students back into school is doing exposures at school. So we support them, you know, first, maybe we'll have them ride the bus and then their therapist will pick them up at the school and come back to the office. And then, you know, we practice going inside and being, you know, in the hallway for 10 minutes. And then we go back to the office and then we slowly build it so that by the time they're ready to graduate from program and get back into the school, they feel supported. Our clinicians are talking with the school counselors, are making sure that they have accommodations in place. And then also making sure that if we do need an additional resource for IEPs or 504s, that we're bringing in educational advocates or, you know, other people that can help support the family with that education piece. And so I've worked at programs where they have a case manager whose job is exclusively to meet with the school counselors to help with transition. People in my position also spend time really educating school counselors and school mental health staff on different levels of care and what happens in an IOP and why students would be in an IOP, you know, that sort of thing. So really, and if there's not a lot of communication happening between a program and the school, that's really when the parent can get in too and be that advocate, right? And be pushy, be annoying. You know, if you feel like you're being too pushy, that's okay. That's your child. And we want to make sure that your child is safe and happy and healthy. And so, you know, mental health professionals and people in the field also get bogged down and busy. And so if you're a parent and you're advocating, I would say most mental health professionals are really accepting of that and really appreciative of that for parents who really care and really advocate. So I would say if that's not happening, you as a parent can really step in and be that connector and be that advocate.
Understanding the different levels is incredibly important. It all seems pretty expensive. So can you help kind of talk about insurance, either in network or out of network? How does that work even from kind of your entry, not that to your most intense and how to kind of cover some of the cost or defray some of the cost?
Yeah. So insurance is a really big, confusing, ginormous thing that is, you know, a thorn in most people's side, but a necessary evil, right? And so I would say if you're looking for mental health support, you can almost always find in-network or out-of-network options that your insurance will work with. So I would say first tip is to really be an expert in your own insurance coverage. So call your insurance company. So if you're looking into mental health services, call your insurance company, tell them what you're looking for, and ask them what their options are and what's covered and what's not. When you're looking at different websites or talking with different therapists, asking them if they're in network or out of network, and if they're in network, what insurance they accept. Out of network benefits, I think, are the biggest confusing piece for families, because you can see an out-of-network therapist, but then still have coverage through your insurance company using your out-of-network benefits. So some people have out-of-network benefits, some don't. And so really understanding what benefits you have and where you can apply them. And I would say first step is really talking with your insurance company, asking questions, again, being that advocate, staying on the phone with them as long as you need to really understand kind of what.
Just get a snack ahead of time.
Exactly.
Get a snack, clear your calendar, take a lot of deep breaths.
Exactly. Pour a cup of coffee. But yeah, so your insurance can also send you a list of providers that they have in the area that they already are in network with. And so that's always a good place to start. So that's in network versus out of network. And so you can still get coverage out of network. It just depends on the benefits that you have. Single case agreements are another thing that comes up a lot. So especially with higher levels of care. So a lot of programs are technically out of network, but they can do single case agreements. And what that means is they might not be in network. So say you have Aetna, they might not be in network with Aetna, but they can do a single case agreement, meaning that they will work with your individual insurance policy to get coverage for that specific service. So, you know, you have out of network benefits, your out of network benefits cover so much, that organization, you know, that residential level of care, for example, can work with the insurance company to say, okay, you guys are going to cover 90 days of treatment for this specific service with this specific policy. And they kind of negotiate that between the insurance company and the mental health provider. So that's a single case agreement. So always ask about single case agreements. It's always worth a shot to ask. And if they don't do it, that's okay. But definitely higher levels of care oftentimes will do single case agreements. Deductibles and co-payments. So a lot of therapists have, you know, would have a copay when you go see a therapist, and it's the same as going to a doctor's office. So, you know, depending on your insurance policy, you might have to spend so much to hit your deductible before you are able to pay that $10 copayment, or, you know, whatever it is. It just really depends on each policy. And something that I run into a lot is people being surprised about different policies, even within the same insurance provider. So if one person has Blue Cross Blue Shield and another person has Blue Cross Blue Shield, their insurance policies are almost never the same. And so it's really about, you know, there has been some level of frustration with families seeking services, like, oh, I thought you took Blue Cross Blue Shield, why don't you take my specific policy? And it's like, well, your policy doesn't have out-of-network benefits, and so we can't utilize those. And so it really is just about, you know, being your own expert in your own policy and being able to say what you have to mental health providers. And then I should also say that most larger mental health providers that do higher levels of care will have specific teams that work with insurance, but a lot of outpatient providers who are in their own private practice do not have staff that work specifically with insurance. So you are going to have to do a little bit more heavy lifting as the policy owner, finding out, you know, what coverage you have with your outpatient therapist. Whereas if you go to a residential program or a PHP, you give them your insurance card. Oftentimes they will work that out with the insurance company and tell you what is covered. So yeah, it also just depends on different level of care.
You had mentioned that when I call an insurance company, they're going to give me a list of providers. So where do I even start looking? Even if I have a list, what is your tips for parents to find a provider that seems to align with kind of who they are as a family and that would be able to support their kiddo?
Yeah, so your list of providers from your insurance company is always a great place to search first. There's also a great website called Psychology Today. And I'm always surprised that people don't know about Psychology Today. And it's such a good resource because you can go in, you can filter for the area that you want to see a therapist in, you can filter for your insurance, you can filter for different issues. So, say your child is dealing with depression, you can find a therapist, you can filter for depression and find a therapist. And you can read through bios to say, the therapist explain what their experiences, what their passions are, what their specialties are in all of their Psychology Today profiles. And so you can start there and just start reaching out to therapists through Psychology Today. They even have like a little form that allows you to send messages. So it makes it pretty easy. I would say when you're first starting out trying to find resources, interview at least three clinicians before you make a decision on who you're going to go to. Also, clinicians will typically offer like a 15-minute consultation call for new clients. So you can really get to know a clinician, ask questions about your specific situation, ask questions about how they conduct their therapy, you can ask them what modalities would be best for these symptoms that I'm explaining, and do you have experience in those modalities? Because, if you're dealing with depression, you're probably not going to want to go see an ERP therapist because that's exposure for depression isn't really what we do, right? So yeah, so when you're trying to look for therapists, narrow it down to a few, get in contact with them, schedule those 15-minute consultations, and really just spend that time interviewing them. You want to find the best fit for you. And also know that if you decide to go with clinician and you have a couple of sessions and it's not really working, you don't really love the clinical relationship, you can always find a new therapist. And you can also tell your therapist, hey, I don't really think that this is the best fit. Do you have any other recommendations for me? And that can feel awkward and weird, but therapists want the best treatment for clients in general. And therapists know that they're not going to be a good fit for every client. And so again, it goes back to being an advocate, asking questions, not really taking no for an answer until you really find the right fit. And so that's one thing. There are also organizations that you can look into for specific symptoms. For example, for OCD, we have IOCDF or the International OCD Foundation. I think that's what the full acronym is. But like, so we have IOCDF that you can go find specific practitioners that just specialize in OCD. There's also the American Counseling Association. And I will say I have a PDF for your listeners, so they can look at this on the PDF. So there's different associations that also are good hubs for mental health resources. They have like a find a therapist button. You can type in your zip code and start looking from there. So there's a lot of different ways to kind of find outpatient therapists, and it really is just about finding the best fit for your personality and for your symptoms. And then as far as higher levels of care, I would rely on those outpatient therapists to recommend a higher level of care if they think that it's necessary. And oftentimes they will have different programs that they've vetted themselves that they like to refer to. If you find yourself as a parent with a child in the hospital will also have resources for you. So again, asking questions, getting all the lists that you can, doing as much research as you can, and then finding the best fit really is the best way to go.
What are some tips for the first sessions? We've kind of figured out our level of care. We've talked to our insurance company. We've had conversations trying to figure out which therapist would be the best suited for our family's needs. And now I have to go to this first session. What are some tips?
Yeah, so outside of consulting with at least three clinicians, I do think that that's so important is like doing those consultations. In that first session, asking about their background and their experience, especially in relation to what you're dealing with. So, if there's a substance use, if you're going to treatment for substance use, you want to make sure that you have someone who has experience with substance use and really understands that. The oftentimes we have complicated cases, right, where we're dealing with trauma and an eating disorder and anxiety. And so finding a therapist who may have experience with those three things and those overlapping symptoms. So really asking them about their background, their theoretical framework, the modalities that they have training in, that they have expertise in, and how those modalities can help with the thing that you're specifically coming in for, the populations they've served, and then also talking about fees and insurance is also important. And then the other thing is really just verifying that your insurance will cover it. So in that first appointment, making sure that you know what your insurance is covering and what it's not. And oftentimes it depends on the outpatient practice if they're going to be an expert at insurance or not. I'll give myself as an example. My therapist was like, "Oh, just tell me how much your copay is," and I just Venmo him. So, he hasn't even I'm not sure what he does on the back end for his insurance stuff, but at least I know what my copay is and I make sure that he has the copay. And so it really just depends on the practice if they're gonna know enough about insurance. And so verifying beforehand what the insurance situation is of that practice and then making sure you know how much it's going to be is really important. But yeah, I think really just knowing, getting a feel for that, how that relationship is going to be. Are they, do you want someone who's going to be a little bit more warm and comforting bring in kind of different types of modalities, or do you want someone who's going to be really frank and to the point? Does like gender of the clinician matter to you or your child? That's something important to look into too. So during that first appointment, really just kind of getting a vibe, asking them about themselves, asking about their approach to therapy. And if that's something that you like, then wonderful. And if it's not, then you can look elsewhere.
When you speak with families, it certainly feels like it's a marathon. So what are tips that you give families that this is not a sprint, not maybe not a one and done, this is going to be a marathon? What tips can you give parents to kind of support that as they're navigating the mental health journey with their child?
I would say get your own support as a parent. That is the biggest thing is, the stress of having a child who is in crisis, who needs additional support, the stress of taking them to appointments and navigating the stress of finding a therapist. I forgot to mention, there's a lot of frustration with parents, and I understand this with practices and clinicians not calling back and not returning inquiries for, first appointments. And so I would say to avoid that particular frustration, when you're reaching out to practices, when you're calling and emailing, asking specifically, do you have openings? Is there a wait list? How long should I expect to be waiting for a response? And if you're reaching out to people and they're not getting back to you within a week or two, then moving on and trying to find someone else. There are plenty of clinicians who have openings in the area who will be able to help. It's just about finding them. But I do understand that that specific piece is really frustrating. And so it's really about casting a wide net until you can get people to kind of return your calls. And I think that after COVID, during COVID, clinicians are really inundated with everyone seeking mental health resources. And, oftentimes practices don't have additional admin staff or, lots of different therapists who can respond to emails. It's just, maybe five people and they're trying to keep up and they just can't. And so be patient with clinicians as well. You can do a couple of follow-ups, but if you're not getting responses, just move on and, try not to get too frustrated. But I think really it's just about having your own supports, being a and you know being able to lean on family and friends and your supportive network too, and talking about it really is something that I've heard from parents all the time who have kids who are going through whatever level of treatment they're going through, is that it feels so isolating. It feels so lonely because you feel like you're the only family going through this, and that is just not the case, right? And so talking about it, decreasing the stigma, saying, like, we're going through kind of a hard time right now because Joey has just stopped wanting to hang out with his friends. And that's really scary for me as a parent, and just talking to your friends about it, talking to your network, because the more that you lean on people, the more that you talk about it and destigmatize children going to mental health treatment, the less lonely you feel and the more support you get, really. So many parents that I've talked to after they've reached out to friends, or they've seen their friends who are they didn't know their child was in crisis. They've seen their friends in a group, or they've, run into other parents who are going to the same kind of support services as them. And they're like, oh my God, I didn't know that you guys were going through this too. And so, really leaning on your people, we know just in general, to be mentally healthy and well, it's best to have a support network. And so, for parents, really utilizing that. And a lot of times in higher levels of care, at least, they will offer support services for parents. So, for example, I know through Anxiety Institute, we have a once a month free webinar for all parents. And I can send this to you as well, Wendy. We have a free webinar that kind of covers topics of anxiety and OCD. And so there's, a college transition webinar coming up, and things like that. And then part of our program is a parent network meeting once a month, where all of our parents of all of our programs kind of come together and they talk about a specific topic. Like this week, they're talking about social media and how to help your child navigate social media and stress around that. And so many private practices also have parent groups. And so if group is kind of your thing and you like meeting people that way, then there's tons of options for that as well, not just individual therapy for parents. So yeah, that's what I would recommend.
As we wind down, what is something that I did not ask, that I should have asked, that I didn't know enough to ask?
I don't know if it's something you didn't ask, but definitely just a tip for parents is that you're doing okay and you're doing your best. Just so many parents that I talk to are they're dealing with this shame around, why does my child need mental health support? What did I do wrong? What are we not doing as parents? And just beating yourself up that way is just really unfair to you as a parent. Our kids have so many stressors that we didn't have when we were kids, and it's difficult for parents to navigate and to support. And so parents, you're really doing your best, and sometimes your best is finding resources for your child, and that's what you have to do. And so just a word of support to parents is that you're amazing, you're doing amazing. And if your child needs mental health services and needs mental health support, it's not your fault, and it's amazing that you're helping them get that support. So, stay strong, stay resilient, and you'll get through it.
I love that. And I usually end, but I feel like you have answered it with a final question of if you had one tip for a billboard, what would it be and why? But I feel like you just summed it up in such a beautiful bow for everyone.
Yeah, my billboard say mental health matters. So yeah, it really does matter. And yeah, we gotta do our best, stick together to help our kids be resilient and strong. So yeah.
So true. So true. Well, I cannot overstate how helpful this was. And I know that our conversation and the resources that we're going to put in the show note is going to be invaluable to parents that are listening and professionals. So thank you so much, Alex, for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you again for tuning in to another episode of the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I hope you found today's podcast insightful and valuable. Before we sign off, remember to show your support by liking, sharing, and subscribing to our podcast. Your engagement helps us continue our mission of empowering families and bridging learning gaps in special education. Don't forget to spread the word about the Special Ed Strategist podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues who may benefit from our content. Together, we can make a difference in the lives of children with special needs. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I can't wait to bring you more inspiring content in the future. Until next time, stay informed, stay inspired, and keep making a positive impact. Goodbye for now.